So the topic at the center on Monday nights for the next 5 weeks we've got left is emotional wisdom. And what we're doing is we're exploring, you could say, sort of the emotional equivalent of wisdom in the Buddhist tradition, which can be worked on directly. You know, you don't need to... Well, you can work on the emotions. There's a meditation we teach called the Metta Bhavana. And the Metta Bhavana is the first basic meditation that you get introduced to. And in the Metta Bhavana then kind of expands and can kind of become more detailed, you could say. You get a better emotional vocabulary. And that emotional vocabulary is what the Brahma Viharas is talking about. And there's four different Brahma Viharas, one of them being Metta. So over the next 4 weeks, and tonight's the first one, we're going to be exploring these four Brahma Viharas. So if you missed last week, which was the introduction, I believe the recording is... It's on the website now, underneath this theme. So you could talk to Natalie if you want. Natalie is our center manager, and she could direct you to where it is. Yes, round of applause for Natalie. Well-placed and appropriate applause. But tonight, so I've got Helen here who's going to do some or give us some reflections on metta. But what I wanted to do is just introduce you to metta a little bit prior to her kind of reflections, because they'll be quite personal in nature, and she'll flesh out probably and make more real what I tell you. I do have a handout, which I'll put over there. I think there's 20 copies, so there's probably not enough for everybody, but take one. Don't hesitate from taking one. If there aren't enough, you don't get one, just tell Natalie and we can sort it out. Or email me directly if you know me, and I'll email you a copy. So metta is a Pali word, Pali being an ancient Indian language. The Sanskrit equivalent is Maitri, and it's related to the word mitta or mitra, which means friend. So metta, and there's no exact English equivalent to the word metta in our language. So it's not something that's easy to translate. But if we were going to translate it, we translate it as something like friendliness, loving kindness, goodwill, maybe care and concern. So I want to talk about three qualities of metta, and say that metta is, in a way, metta is the antidote to, it's the antidote for indifference. So when you're kind of like you don't care, well, it's just like a lackluster sort of approach to life. If you've got that kind of emotional response to things, one of the ways of addressing it is just to try and develop a bit of care, to take an interest in, to develop some friendliness. So the three qualities, there's some seats over here too on the other side. Oh, you're assorted. That's fine. Just sit there. Yeah, that's great. So the three qualities of metta I want to draw out, and I'm drawing this from a book called Living with Kindness, which is written by Sangharakshita, and I think all the copies have been sold because the men's study group on Thursday picked it up to study it. But the three qualities are ardent goodwill. So the word ardent, I think, literally means to burn. Yeah? But when we talk about an ardent goodwill, metta is a down-to-earth kind of friendliness for other people. Yeah? It's practical. It makes us move. It's an emotion. Yeah? It makes us act. And it is, if we think about friendliness is the kernel, the start of a feeling of metta. So if you've got a friendly feeling towards somebody, that in a way is the initial spark of metta. And if you fan that spark, if you blow on it, it will kind of flower into something more. So metta doesn't mean that you need to be friends with somebody necessarily, but metta is the sort of response to another person that leads to friendships. Yep. So if you're feeling metta towards somebody, then a friendship could arise if the conditions were such that it would, you know? But in the absence of that, there is still this metta towards them. And also, just so that we don't think of metta as a sort of a tepid kindness, metta is an ecstatic energy. It has passion in it. Yep. It is a passionate response to life. So if you think, in some ways, when you're trying to find your way into emotional wisdom, when you get angry, the emotionally wise response is not to push the anger down. The emotionally wise response is to try and understand the anger, to try and figure out what it is that's getting frustrated. Yeah? What are the values there that aren't being able to be expressed? And it's because you want to tap into the energy that's within anger. Yeah? So in some ways, sometimes we think of the angels as being quite sweet, and we think of Satan as being quite kind of powerful and kind of strong. And we can get into a false sense that metta is somehow tepid and weak and kindly and emasculated. But in fact, metta is far from that. Metta is quite passionate, quite strong, and you could use the word ecstatic for it. Actually, the Buddha says something that's good. He says of metta that it burns and shines and blazes forth. And that's a quote. It's a translation, but it's a quote. So metta does burn, shine, and blaze forth. And I think you'll know this. When you have that feeling of joy and care and connectedness with life, it does burn, shine, and blaze forth. You know, it does. It does. So the third one I want to talk about, and I need to make sure I don't go too long, but the third one I want to talk about is that metta is also a rational emotion. So by this, what I mean by this, and actually it's what Sangharakshita was saying, because I'm just kind of repeating his words. When he says it's a rational emotion, what he means is that it's appropriate to reality. Yeah? And what he talks about is, like, say, for example, the understanding that that we're not so different from every other human being. Yeah? That the world does not revolve around us. Yeah? Those are examples of intellectual understandings that are appropriate to reality. Yeah? That other people are like us, very similar to us, in their pursuit of happiness and their attempt to get away from pain. And that that everybody, in a way, kind of everybody experiences the world as the hub of it. You know, I hate to break to you, but you know, even though the whole world revolves around your consciousness, which it does, you've only known the world from the hub, the center of your consciousness. The world, nonetheless, does not revolve around you. But it took me a while to figure that out as a kid, to be honest. But if you start to realize that, and start to realize that other people, you know, kind of, that they are sentient like you, metta is the natural emotional response to that. It's sort of a care for another sentient being like you that's going through the world trying to find happiness. That is really what everybody's doing. We're trying to find happiness in our lives. Is there anybody in this room not doing that? Don't be shy. Yeah, okay. So those are three ways to think about metta. So when we talk about any of these emotions, there's a far enemy and a near enemy. The far enemy is the opposite, and in this case, it's hatred. Yeah? Hatred is the far enemy of metta. Yeah? The near enemy is selfish attachment. So when it comes to hatred, usually what happens with hatred is that we're trying to find happiness in the world, and something frustrates us. Something gets in our way. I was experiencing it just as I drove over here. I was going down Miola Road, and this really slow car pulled in front of me. They were doing like 30 in a 50-mile-an-hour zone, which I must confess I always do 60 in. So they were doing about half the speed limit. And it's just like, I had to think, what's going on? I mean, and I realized, well, actually, if you've ever driven Miola Road when cars are parked on both sides, it's quite tight. You know? And I thought, well, they're just probably a new driver. They've either never driven this road before, or they've just got their permit. And I thought, well, if I was them, I'd drive slow too. And so realizing that, I was able to kind of let go of the hatred a little bit. but hate. Okay, it wasn't hatred, it was frustration. But it was hatred, you think?
Yes, it was hatred.
So that's the opposite of metta. It's a real self-centered sort of something's getting in the way of my happiness, and I must destroy it, push it away, move it out of the way in order to be happy. Yeah? The near enemy of metta, this selfish affection, selfish attachment, is when you see your joy being kind of having a particular, in a way, manifestation. So the classic example of this is a parent with a child. The child, you know, basically the parent wants the child to become to play a musical instrument, and therefore forces the child to practice and everything, even though the child really doesn't want to. Yeah? And the parent is just like, well, look, this is for your own good. Yeah? It's really important that you learn to play an instrument. And now, there might be some truth in that. I'm not saying that parents shouldn't encourage their children to play instruments. But what I'm saying is that in some ways it's better if that's done in dialogue with the child, particularly as the child gets older. Because when the parent sort of bases its happiness on what the child does or is, then it's this kind of opposite of metta, you know, or the near enemy of metta. You start to try, and out of a sense of care, you want things to be a particular way, you demand them to be that way, and you say, well, it's because I care, but in fact, it's really about you. You know, you don't care for the other being as another sentient being searching for happiness. You basically want them to be a particular way so you can be happy. Yeah? So I think it comes close to also, I think, control sometimes. It's, for me, it's a bit of control. It's like I kind of want the right solution to a situation. And I want the right solution because I care, but actually the antidote to that is compassion, which is realizing that the situations around us have a life of their own. And you can try to influence it, you can care about it, but in the end you have to step back and let it make its own course. You have to let it do its own thing. Yeah? And so there's an element of compassion there, of stepping back, of not over-identifying with what that person does or chooses. And that can be really hard too, particularly if it's someone you really care about when somebody you really care about and they're doing stuff that either is causing you difficulty or causing themselves difficulty, can be really, really challenging to let go in that one. So that's the far enemy, the near enemy, and three aspects of metta. And I need to let Helen now kind of reflections. So
over the past few weeks, I've been thinking a lot and reflecting on how I view metta and how I cultivate it. And interestingly, I noticed that the closer the talk came, the more grumpy and irritable I became, until I'm afraid to say that actually last week I just had a total emotional meltdown. And I thought, what am I doing? This is not a particularly metaphor response to myself or my family. And especially as it was after going to some mindfulness supervision where I talked about how I was reflecting on metta a lot and how it was really present in my life. And then I got home and had, you know, a little bit of a cry and a shout at my husband about the fact that the lunch boxes hadn't been made because I had a metta talk to finish and I didn't have time to do them. So... And in that moment, I just had this really wonderful insight about the true nature of metta. And it was an understanding that went beyond words. And it was kind of a deep knowing, what I would call a sense, a wisdom, an appreciation. So articulating something like that in an ordered and intellectual manner feels a little clumsy. Because it is beyond words on some level. And metta is so simple, this idea of care and loving kindness, and yet so profound. So I'll do my best. I've named this talk Metta and Wisdom and the Path to Insight. And that's just what it is on my Word document, on Microsoft Word at home. And I think it's here that I come to this koan about part of me just wants to talk straight from the heart, because that's that connection with metta, that that idea that it's beyond words, it's beyond just me. And then the part of me that's conditioned and that's ego-driven just wants to say exactly what I've written on the page. So I think tonight maybe I'll do a little bit of both and I'll follow the middle path. So I was talking with my husband and explaining a little bit about this talk, and I said, I'm talking about metta and the Brahmaviharas, and he said, yeah, I know what they are. And I said, okay, well, I think I have a great capacity for metta and that I felt really connected with it since I was a child. And he sort of nodded politely and kind of smiled. And then I said, actually, though, I also think that I have a great capacity for hatred. And then his response was much more animated. And he went, yeah, I can totally see that. And he's like, I can see, like, you know, with you, fire coming out of your ears and these red laser beams coming out of your eyes. And I sort of laughed lightheartedly. But, and I knew that part of it was a little bit of a joke. But the other part of me felt as if maybe there was some insight into, you know, that point that... into my own delusion that actually I did have a great capacity for hatred. And I think if you met me walking down the street or from just meeting me tonight, you wouldn't say, oh my gosh, that woman, she's just brimming with hatred. It's frightening. But I know that I do have that capacity for hatred, that it's in me. I think that I have a pretty good skill at being nice, and in an everyday existence, in our kind of everyday lives, that's very important. And being nice isn't metta. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Ratna Vyuha touched on that, but I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. So being nice isn't metta. And the reason I know, so the reason going back to hatred, the reason that I know I have this great capacity for hatred is that if somebody hurt someone close to me or someone in my family, I think that I would be able to kill somebody. And that might sound a little bit extravagant and it might sound a bit provocative, but I'm not saying that I'd be able to, that I just walk out and randomly, you know, kill someone. But I think that it's naive of me to think that that my conditioned existence doesn't affect me, and that if somebody really hurt somebody close to me, that I could have that capacity of hatred to do such an act. And I think when I was reflecting on hatred, I realised that out of the three poisons, so in Buddhism there's three poisons, there's greed, hatred and delusion, that actually it's not just hatred, that I have a capacity, and I think all human beings have a capacity for all of those poisons. So I also know about the near enemy, of this idea of selfish attachment or sticky attachment, because I'm a parent and I have two small children, and I love them with all my heart, beyond anything on some level that I could imagine. And there is a power element to that love, because however much I love them, I want them to go to bed on time, and I want them to eat broccoli, and I want them to have manners. And that's okay, because that is part of how they exist in this world, in our kind of social culture. That, you know, what's socially acceptable, it's guidelines for every day. But I feel it's really important to know that however big and spacious my heart is around my children, it's still parental love. And again, it's not metta. So let's go back to metta being more about just being nice. So living a conditioned or mundane life is painful. It's the first noble truth that the life that we live is life is suffering, it's pain. And it's because we see ourselves as fixed individuals. This sense of that our ego, our selfhood is fixed, it's concrete, it exists. And actually everything in this world is impermanent. Everything is changing just moment by moment. And that grasping to hold on to each moment, and that delusion that if we do keep holding on, then it will stay the same, or that it will stay fixed, that's where the suffering comes from. So this concept of impermanence, how each moment is changing all the time, and the whole nature of reality, this whole concept, requires something beyond just being nice to, I guess, to transform and to be able to deal with it. It's also that the three poisons, so greed, delusion, and hatred, they're powerful enemies. And they are always around, and being nice just isn't going to survive or transform them. So metta needs to be something that's limitless, that already exists within us but transcends this conditioned, mundane world. So I knew that metta went, I guess, beyond an intellectual understanding from my own experiences of practicing it, that I realised that actually I needed metta to be bigger than me. I needed it to be bigger than my imagination. I actually needed metta to be bigger than even what my imagination could hold, because it needed to be big enough to transform hatred. And not just any old hatred, it needed to be big enough to transform my hatred. And so just being nice wasn't going to cut it. So metta needs to be limitless because it has such powerful enemies. So what do I really mean by transcending, that metta can transcend this mundane or conditioned experience? So in our everyday lives, we have a fixed sense of self. So we have a fixed sense of self and a constant self-referencing. So that's how we relate to the world in terms of our own grasping. And what I mean by this is that we see things from a view of what we can get out of them, or how they will affect us. So me, my, I, what's happening in my world. And so if we were able to break through this illusion of a fixed sense of self, we'd be able to see that we're not separate. And actually, we would really see, and I mean really see, another human being. And so metta isn't based on conditions. It isn't dependent on our own ego. And so it's not dependent on how it reacts to others. We aren't looking to see what we can get out of it by practicing metta. Because if we did, if it was based on conditions and what we would receive out of it, then it would just be about being a nicer person, because it would have limits. Because the limits would be whether we meditated that day, you know, whether we were let in on a difficult right turn in the rush hour traffic, or whether somebody smiled at us as they, you know, as they made our coffee in the morning. And actually, it's something bigger than that. And we have to say that it needs to be, because it has, again, such powerful enemies. So metta is limitless. So if we go back to this sense of love, romantic love or parental love, they all have a certain kind of power or control element. And so it's useful because sometimes when we feel like we've got a heart full of metta, actually it's parental or romantic love. Because again, there's an element of control that's surrounding it. That there's some string attached to it. And a way that we can, that's a kind of a good example, is it's really difficult to love someone if they don't love you back. And we can see how that changes of being in and out of love in different relationships. I think that's why it is useful to use the word metta rather than translating it into loving kindness or friendliness, because it isn't a straightforward meaning. It has other elements than to just being kind. So metta transcends this conditioned experience, and there are no strings attached to it. So it's independent of all conditions. And because of that, metta goes hand in hand with wisdom. Because if it didn't go hand in hand with wisdom, it would again be limited. And I think it's important to remember, and you might have heard this before, but metta is limitless. So I really like the way that Sangharakshita talks about love in the Ten Pillars. And he has a quote where he says, "Love, which is the positive form of the first precept, is no mere flabby sentiment, but the vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings." So it's about seeing ourselves and others as impermanent, continually changing, fluid in a moment-by-moment process. So when our identity isn't quite so strong, we can see other points of view, and we can really see another person without our own ego being projected onto them. And this wisdom is really going beyond the distinction of self and other and seeing another human being without our own subjective view placed upon them. So that's where the Metta Bhavana practice comes in. And in the first two stages of the Metta Bhavana, we establish a sense of love and goodwill and well-wishing for ourselves and for a good friend. But I feel when we really shift into developing this boundless love, into developing metta, is when we start to look at the neutral person. Because with the neutral person, there are no strings attached. Their experience, their suffering, without a sense of separation, is a way to really feel a sense of connectedness, that interconnectedness. So with no grasping, no hatred or delusion or thinking that things are fixed, we can see impermanence and this sense of interconnectedness with other people as beautiful. And we can see how we can develop metta more openly and more vigorously by being able to access this sense of beauty. So an example of this is a rainbow. Because rainbows don't often last very long. They're continually changing depending on the weather, what angle you look at them. And in some sense, they are ephemeral. They don't really exist. You can't touch them or find the end of them. And yet they're exceedingly beautiful. So to see humans and our whole experience as impermanent, as changing every moment, we can just delight in it. And rather than dread or attempt to hold on to something or fear the change, we're able to embrace metta and this idea of delighting in human beings and their fragile nature and the fragile nature of impermanence. So how do we come into contact with metta? And this is through the Metta Bhavana practice, but also through nature and music and the arts. And to those things, or to those feelings that get you when you just tear up and you're not sure why, or you feel the hairs on the back of your neck or on your arms just stand up, or you feel like your heart's wants to sing and is really joyful. And those moments are the really important moments to connect with, because metta goes beyond words. And those moments are when we're able to drop down into a deeper sense of wisdom and a connection with ourselves and others. So we have a sense of knowing inside, real knowing of what it's like to feel this limitless metta. And so I just wanted to, invite everyone to open up to a reflection and to their own experience of metta, and just allowing, letting go of any sense of concept and just allowing yourself to kind of drop deeper into your own experience. So I'm going to read a poem. So if you feel comfortable too, just closing your eyes and getting comfy. And this is a poem called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. So before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you have held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in the white poncho lies, dead by the side of the road. You must see that this could be you. How he was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know the kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the threads of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crown of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend.